Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I've been waiting for, I'm going to use the word literally right here, literally months to do this interview because the guest who's joining me today created a beverage company, sold it to Pepsi, started another company. The new company now is Flying Embers. It does organic hard kombucha. Nobody can see it because people are listening to the audio version of this, but I'm holding it up here. And the reason I've been dying to do this interview is his team generously sent me a box full of it. And I felt, I can't drink it before the interview. That feels wrong. It's here for the interview. And then if you guys heard my interview with Thomas from FE International, I said, Thomas, you're here in person. How am I not going to drink with you? And we're going to drink scotch, of course, but I've had this thing. Would you mind doing a taste test with me? And if it's awkward that we hate it, we'll have to talk about it because we're in here in person. If we love it, then great. We're going to have a good time. He and I never had hard kombucha. I always hated kombucha, to be honest with you. It has this weirdo sour taste that my wife loves. She fills our refrigerator with it. I couldn't get into it. We freaking love this thing. And so I basically said, can we get the guest on here so I can do this interview? Yes, I want to find out how he sold his company to Pepsi, but also I'd like to finally get to tear into this, especially now considering what's going on in the world. All right, let me introduce him properly. His name is Bill Moses. The company that I'd like to spend a lot of time talking about is called Kavita. If you don't recognize the name, you probably recognize the bottle. It's been at all of our grocery stores here in San Francisco, I feel like, at least the ones that my family shops in. And so it's the it's known for kombucha. It makes a line of health beverages that Pepsi acquired. I want to find out how he launched it, how he grew it, and then why he's coming back and doing a hard drink, hard meaning alcohol. And we're going to find out how he did it all thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first will host your website, right? It's called HostGator. The second will help you hire phenomenal developers. It's called TopTal. We'll talk about those later and why you should go check them out. But first, Bill, thanks for being here.
Awesome. Great to be here.
The number's public, but I like big numbers. Would you feel comfortable telling us how much you sold to Pepsi for?
Sure, yeah. We sold for $230 million.
How much of that do you get at the end? Is that too weird to ask you as a how you doing question?
Well, I got well into double digits. I'll just put it that way.
I always ask my guests, how did you, do you remember the day you made the deal? Some do remember, some don't. I have a feeling you're going to remember because what happened? You were driving on Ventura from what I heard as you were like talking to who?
I was actually talking to the counterpart at PepsiCo when they were actually delivering the confirmation of the price and the date of closing. And I was on the 101 and sure enough, I got distracted and I ran my car into the back of a Tesla and ended up getting towed off the road. And that was that.
And did that work out? That call actually, did you?
They actually heard the crash and I was unavailable after that for about 30 minutes. And it did work out.
Why were you doing this? What was going through your head at the time? Was it the sense of I have to do this or it's just the way you were driving? Were you anxious?
Well, I think I was distracted. I was really, I was definitely, definitely very anxious and it was distracting. So it definitely took my eyes off the road. I was looking at the road, but I was thinking of different things.
How did it change your life to have done this deal?
It's really interesting. Well, you know, from a professional perspective, you know, there's, you know, it's really the grand prize is to build a brand and to sell it to a major CPG company. So it really changed my life insofar as giving me a lot of currency with a lot of new brands, other brands, entrepreneurial brands, many of which I've gone on the board and I'm advising. So it really gave me currency in the space that enabled me to take the expertise and the experience in beginning and operating and selling to other younger companies. And that's really a love I have is building a brand and positioning a brand and working with young entrepreneurs so that they could take the experience I have and hopefully be a benefit to them.
I heard you were one of these kids growing up who was just constantly hustling. Did you ever have a lemonade stand?
Yeah, I actually did have a lemonade stand. I had, actually at the time it was, I think it was a Kool-Aid stand, actually. It wasn't even a lemonade stand. It was back in the day where I took Kool-Aid mixes and mixed them up on a hot day and put some ice in it and sold it. So not lemonade, but something a little easier to make.
Because of what? Because you were just, yeah, why?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I really love connecting with people and, you know, and getting them and transacting with them and engaging with them and interacting with them. So the ultimate form of interaction, I think, you could either go the heart way and have a love interaction, or you can go the secular way and have a business interaction. And so as it relates to that, I really love interacting with people. And that was one way to interact with them.
Yeah. It feels like the commercial way of interacting is, we underestimate the fact that it is an interaction. It is almost, there's a line in the movie Barbarians at the Gate where the head of Nabisco said, when people buy you, they buy what you're selling. It's like, or when they buy what you're selling, they buy you. The sense that they're showing you the way that they show a comic that they like them as they applaud, the way they show you as a hustler is that they're buying your stuff. Am I right? Like, the lemonade, the baseball cards, the other stuff that you were selling growing up, it feels like it's all connected that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there's something deeply rewarding about, you know, making something, crafting something that others enjoy and they benefit from. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, that's the ultimate in my ability to express myself. Others express themselves with music or with different forms of the creative arts or engineering or programming or, you know, gamifying. And for me, it's making a product and building a brand and having it be something more than just what it is, having it be something that represents something that someone could emotionally connect with. That's really something.
Before this, you started Recovery Television Network. I looked it up. What was it?
Yeah. So, in 99, 2000, we started a nonfiction programming service. And back in the day when cable was proliferating, there was going to be 500 channels and, so we created a channel that was nonfiction that really dealt with people's behavioral health issues. And we had a helpline that helped people when they were in a time of need. And it was telecast into the privacy of one's own home, and it dealt with behavioral health issues. If someone had a substance abuse issue, or if they had depression, or if they were, you know, mentally unstable and potentially suicidal, or were part of domestic abuse, sexual abuse, all these behavioral issues that people really didn't want to speak about, we gave them an opportunity to connect with us and give them information so that they could do something about it. That was really great. It was really a rewarding programming service that we did back then.
I thought of it as a place for addicts to see programming geared towards them. I'm looking at an old Los Angeles Times article from 1993 that called it a wellness channel. Did you start off with dealing with addiction and then expand, or was it?
Yeah, we started with addiction. Yeah. And then we broadened it for many reasons, because when you look at addiction, there's oftentimes an underlying cause, whether it be sexual abuse or domestic abuse or, you know, a host of things. So we wanted to cast a wider net to really be more inclusive, all in some sort of relationship with one another.
No, a lot of, by the way, those beeps go off the whole day as you work. It doesn't distract you. I'm going to ask you to turn it off, but I don't even know that you know how to turn it off. It's Outlook, isn't it?
That is.
So, Outlook buries that thing so deep in their settings. You don't get distracted by that?
I do. And I'm not usually so tied to my computer where it's an issue. So let's keep talking. And when
let's
we
keep
talk
talking. About, I, if you find yeah. it, find it. But I don't want it to distract you from this conversation. I'm trying to understand why you. I'm looking at your background. I don't see why you would get into television. You're a guy who worked the back office of Bear Stearns. You then helped create the computerized reservation system for the People's Republic of China so that people can book airplane flights and hotels, right? Am I right?
Yeah.
How do you end up with a television network? That's more of a Ted Turner type of thing.
Yeah, right. That's a great story. Well, it turns out that one of my good friends was actually in the cable industry. and I was working on Wall Street, and he brought me this business. And you know, my mother was you know, in recovery, and I had a lot of experience related to family issues and dynamics, and I realized that you know, you could do well and by doing good, and somehow or another I got really pulled into it and felt compelled to get behind it. So I think there's a personal connection.
Do you feel comfortable telling us what happened in your background and your mom? I mean,
my mother was she grew up really she was an immigrant and grew up in Pittsburgh, and she had she had some challenges. She was an alcoholic, and it culminated into a nervous breakdown that she had when I was 14 years old. She came out of it. She got into recovery and got healthy, and you know, so a lot of her issues I lived with, and I realized that I didn't have anywhere to go or talk to anybody about it. And
what do you mean? What did you live with?
I lived with a mother that wasn't always there.
And so, how did that affect you personally?
It made me angry. You know, really made me angry. It made me not really understand. I didn't understand why this was happening. I wanted to blame her, but I realized it was something else. And so for me, it was deeply troubling and upsetting. And I think that, you know, in my teen years, my early teen years, especially, I was angry, and I took a lot of that energy into sports and athleticism. Mm-hmm. That enabled me to really find a catharsis for it. And, that was sort of a,
And do you ever break yourself of it, or did it help you when you were working at Bear Stearns, when you were working?
I think there's a little bit of there is the cycle of addiction, and it comes in many forms and fashions. And in some cases it makes what people might be considered as great. And in other cases it's not so great. But for me, I kind of have a work, I love to work. So whether you want to call it a work addiction, I have a deep desire to work, to be worthy, and to provide others with something of value. And whether or not that came by nature or by nurture, I don't know. But I think it's related in some way to my childhood with my mother.
And the network that you started to help people who are in your situation, in your mom's situation, was in joint venture with Liberty Media. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah,
this was the huge unknown. Like, most people don't know Liberty Media, but they owned a bunch of channels. It was owned by John Malone. I think it still is, right?
They invest in programming services, mm-hmm. and cable networks, but programming services from BET, Discovery Channel, A&E, et cetera, et cetera. So having them as a partner was validating for sure. What was interesting was that during that time, you know, there wasn't a lot of sponsorship dollars interested in being associated with things of this nature.
I didn't think of that. Right. Yeah. Right. And so then what happened to the channel?
So the channel ended up going under, but we sold what we did was we had two businesses. We took the cable network, the internet network, and the programming. We developed a partnership with, at the time was America, AOL Digital Cities, and at the time it was the way AOL, which was a way of communicating via the internet. This is 20 years now ago, and they had local programming. So we tied in local programming and all of our services to AOL, and we ended up spinning that off and selling that back to Liberty Media, and took the programming network that was the television piece and took that under. So it was it was a mixed bag of success for the joint venture, but not great success or any success for the investors and the broadcast.
But you did well financially, it seems like.
Okay.
You could take on a hobby, as you told our producer. You said, I got into winemaking, which is, I don't know if it was a throwaway line, but you said winemaking, the folly of the rich. What got you excited about winemaking all of a sudden?
Yeah, I don't ask her question. Why I went to school in when I was at college, I took a semester overseas to the south of France. I was struggling with my language requirement at the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. So one way of getting through that was to do an exchange program student. And I went to the American University down in Aix-en-Provence. And I lived with a country garage winemaker. And I learned about French wine while I was going to school there.
Oh, wow.
Fast forward, I get out of there. I go to Wall Street. I work on Wall Street, then become an entrepreneur. And da-da-da-da-da. Here I fast forward. And I'm like, I love to grow. I love wine. And I started growing grapes. And I started a winery. And then I got really into the fermentation. The piece that really turned me on was the alchemy of the fermentation process and all of that.
And I remember talking to, I forget which one of my guests, I thought it was Hotelier, but you know what? I forget who it was, about how you recognize that one of the challenges of being in the wine business is you have to sit on a bottle for 18 to 24 months, that it's not a fast turnaround, that it's a really slow process. And so how did that shape your thinking about the business?
Well, I mean, when I realized that we could make a fermented drink that didn't require storing for 12 to 24 months or 36 months, I said, well, that's the business I want to be in. So fermentation. So yeah, I think it gave me a reference point on if I'm going to get involved with beverages or fermented beverages, we've got to find a way to do it that could have a faster turn. And so as I was innovating Cavita with good manufacturing practices, we employed a lot of IP to get the fermentation to not occur in 1 year or 1 month, but to do it in 1 week in order to have better economics.
Am I pronouncing this right? My wife, like I said, loves kombucha. We have so much in the house. Especially now because we're stocking up. We don't know when we can leave the house. Am I pronouncing it right? Kombucha?
Kombucha.
Okay, good. I guess sometimes I say kombucha and she laughs. So from what I understand, you started reading up on this. You saw that people were interested in kombucha. You saw it in stores. Tell me a little bit about the research that you did that told you this is worth going into.
Yeah, so I mean, I started to sample them, explore them independent of my own due diligence as a winemaker looking at fermentation and fermented products. A friend of my wife was making a water kefir, which is a different kind of a ferment in her kitchen. And so we partnered up and ended up creating a company, and we launched and made a water kefir ferment that she had perfected in her kitchen. And then I had innovated a kombucha, and then I went forward and found new and innovative ways of making the menu. This is, and CPG manufacturing is everything. So we had to figure out how to manufacture it in a way that would have good economics. And that's what we did for 6 years.
CPG, consumer packaged goods. That's right. What we're talking about, right? You also told our producer, you said, the winery had capital expenditure that I had to unload. What does that mean?
Well, there was a lot of money that goes into wine and winery. And I didn't necessarily have to unload it. I think, my interest shifted. So didn't really unload it. Just, I went from making it a primary business to making it more of a hobby, because there were just the economics were.
You mean the winery? I don't think she meant that you were saying that you wanted to unload the winery, but it seems like you were saying I was losing money at the winery for a while, right? Because this is not a business that you get into and you make money tomorrow. And so if I started another business that made a profit, it seems like tax wise it would cover up for the losses, right? Am I thinking about this right?
Certainly, if you've got. If you make money in one business, you're losing mm-hmm. money in another business. It helps offset the economics. That's all. Yeah. They're two separate entities and businesses.
All right. One of the ways that you sold it in the beginning was consumer intercepts. I'll get that into that in a moment. I should tell people this interview is sponsored by HostGator. If you're building a website, if you've got a website already built, if you're just looking to play, go with the company that's going to save you money, especially now in these tough economic times. Save yourself some money by going with HostGator. They will host you right. They will even migrate you to them if you're already with somebody else. And save some money, allow you to grow your business. If you've never started a company, you've got some time right now while you're watching Netflix, just go sign up with HostGator.com/Mixergy. Start a site, play with it while you're watching something. Goof around. Don't turn it into a business. Let yourself play and explore and learn. And as you do that, you're going to find a passion that will allow you when you're ready to start that business. So again, if you've got a business hosting with a company, move over to HostGator. If it's right for you, it'll save you a ton of money and do you good for your business. If you don't, if you're just looking to experiment, it's an inexpensive way to learn by doing. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. When you use that /Mixergy at the end of the URL, you'll be saving yourself a bunch of money by getting the lowest price that they have, and you'll be telling them that you heard them on Mixergy. HostGator.com/Mixergy. The consumer intercepts. How did that work? How did you personally sell in those early days?
Well, it was really interesting. I had to validate the product, and I have a home that we would have yoga retreats in, actually, or different kinds of it was sort of like a B&B, and we had the buyer from Whole Foods in, and I made up the product and took it to her and all her friends that were all part of this weekend activity, and to see if she liked it. She really liked it, and so that was my first consumer intercept. And then ultimately she helped me get it into Whole Foods. But beyond that, you know, really getting having face-to-face interaction with your target audience around the product is really vital. You get more learnings from that interaction than you do from any kind of survey you do on Suzy or any other sort of service, SurveyMonkey, et cetera. So consumer intercepts gave me direction on flavor, carbonation, design, everything.
And that this is you going to the store, seeing somebody reach out to a similar product saying, hey, would you please try my product?
Exactly. I would go to the shelf that it would sit on. And when they were up there shopping, I'd say, I have a new product. Would you be interested in trying it? And give me your feedback. And
then I feel awkward doing that, walking up to a stranger. No.
If they were open to it, then I was excited. And most people were really excited to see an entrepreneur that was trying to get some feedback on their product. So they were never very shy on giving an opinion once they drank it.
It's got to feel a little bit like going back in time to the lemonade stand where you're just talking to somebody, making one sale at a time, seeing that they like your product and maybe like you and in association. What did you learn specifically by talking to people, by doing those consumer intercepts?
Yeah, first off is I learned, you know, whether or not the particular flavor worked in a fermented beverage. So I learned about flavors, you know, and what flavor works. I learned about acidification. Was it too tart? Was it too bitter? I learned about carbonation. Carbonation in a carbonated drink, you know, how much carbonation is one of the major flavorings.
Oh, you mean that there's some people who don't. Did you notice that people like more carbonation than you thought or less?
Yeah, there was the degree of carbonation could be altered like a flavor.
And what did you find that people liked?
I found that in this particular drink, they wanted less carbonation because it was already sort of a bitey, tart flavor that they didn't want something too carbonated that would add to that. And then, you know, also, you know, we learned about sweetness and then we learned about brand. I mean, we would show them labels and get feedback on, you know, our first name of the company was Kefira. It was Kefira. And we were like, people couldn't pronounce it. It was because kefir. And while we thought it was cool, people thought it was just, they couldn't identify with it. So then out of the consumer intercepts, we began to ideate around new names and ideas and would take it to them and directionally got the name that we ultimately settled on, Kevita.
What is kefir?
well, kefirik is, ki is effectively chi. When you look at ki, it's in many different languages. It represents chi or energy. Kefira is actually kefir. It was.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant. What's kefir?
Kefir is a dairy product that comes from the Far East, where a natural bacteria would get into sheep's milk or goat's milk. They would carry it on their saddle in the Caucasus Mountains, the nomads, and what would happen is through the natural bacteria from the flora, the sack of milk that they would carry would begin to curdle and ferment. And it became a digestive aid and an elixir because it had alcohol in it. And that was traditional kefir that then they have made and commercialized in stores. In the dairy area of Sorge, you could buy kefir, which is, which again, it's not fermented, it's not alcohol, but it has a lot of probiotics and it's rich that way. So that's kefir. So one of our drinks is a water kefir. It's the same bacteria that takes this old goat and sheep's milk and turned it into, this is a 2,000-year-old drink, mm-hmm. and turned it into this sort of nourishing elixir that got you a little buzzed. And we found a way to make it in an aqueous format, in a water form, the same bacteria, the same culture, but put it in water and ferment. So that was one of our lines. And so kefira was the name of the beverage line that related to kefir, but it didn't translate to the consumer. And I learned that through a consumer intercept.
And so did you even stop calling it kefir? It looks like, yeah. Is that sparkling probiotic drink?
Yeah. So we changed it to Kavita and the sparkling pro. So we had two lines, the sparkling probiotic drink, which is a water kefir.
Got
which
it.
Originated from the traditional kefir. That was a milk-based product, same bacteria, but we threw our own technology. Anyway, so that was something. And then we came out with the kombucha after that. So
Why. Why not come out with kombucha right away? What was it that you were seeing that it was selling?
Yeah, great question. Well, we positioned ourselves as the antithesis, as the antagonist of kombucha, because the water kefir was a fermented probiotic beverage. But it wasn't a kombucha because it tasted more like a healthy soda drink. And so it was much more consumer friendly. It was softer. It wasn't bitey. It wasn't vinegary. So we went out and challenged all the retailers to say, why would you carry a kombucha when you can carry a Kavita? It does the same thing. It just tastes better.
Yeah.
And that was our way of getting on shelf. So
did that work? Did they say we're going to take this new thing? It did.
Yeah, well, it worked and it worked because we also had help from the 2010 National Kombucha Pool. They pulled the kombucha from market because they had alcohol in the product. So when they pulled that out and we were pitching our stuff, we ended up getting on the shelves of Whole Foods nationwide. So we were successful with that. And we grew that line to $30 million in business. And then I was realizing that kombucha drinkers wanted kombucha and Kavita drinkers, sparkling probiotic drink, wanted that. And I thought, why not make a kombucha and service two different consumers? So then I came out with a kombucha and we drove that to $50 million in sales.
More than the water kefir.
Because it was a category already built and was growing. And so while we were a water kefir, that never developed as a category. We were our own category at mm-hmm. the time. Mm-hmm. So when we made a kombucha, we were part of a growing category and became one of the leaders in that category.
You got to deal with Whole Foods. At the time, Whole Foods encouraged each store to find local entrepreneurs to buy the local food, to feature it in their store. And it seems like that's how you got into Austin. Am I right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
And then you made an exclusive SKU agreement with them. What was that?
Yeah, we at the time, and I think they still do this, they like to be innovators and team with in a new entrepreneurial companies. And so we did a deal where we went exclusive with them on a new innovation. The agreement was, take us, put us on first, give us a shot, and we will be exclusive to you for 6 months or 9 months or a year, depending upon the deal. Mm-hmm. And what they would do is they'd get behind it, launch it, and there at the time was maybe 300 stores. I think they now they have 450. And it would be the proof of concept. You know, getting a retailer behind you to give you enough distribution so that it could be fully representational of the marketplace versus a few mm-hmm. stores in San Francisco or wherever was really important. And they really Whole Foods really made a lot of companies. They validated them, they made them, and ultimately created the better for you food and beverage space by doing such things. There's a lot of gratitude to them in that program.
What was the product that you started off giving them exclusivity on?
The first one was the Sparkling Probiotic Drink, and we did we did the lemon ginger was the first one, and it worked out.
What year did you start off?
We really got going. We incorporated late 2009, but we went to market in 2010. So it was 2010 to, you know, effectively fall of 2016 is when we were.
2009 was a bad year. 2008 was when the world fell apart. Then 2009, the world was suffering from it. It took a while. What was it like to start a company back then?
Good question. It's sort of like starting a company right now.
Yeah.
So it was hard. You know, listen, it was really hard to raise capital. You know, we had to raise capital at a really low valuation, even though we got the initial launch in Whole Foods. And, you know, I remember the private equity owner coming in and meeting with me, and he looked at me and he said, you know, I don't know about this, but I believe in you and I'm going to invest in you. So at the end of the day, it was a lot of luck and a lot of luck to get capitalized at a time when people were not writing checks.
What do you think he saw in you?
That's a good question. I think he saw two things. I think he saw someone that was going to not give up, that I think he really felt a sense of commitment. And the other thing I remember him saying is that he liked the way I put thoughts together. So when he asked me questions and I'm sort of succinct in like how I build from a question into a reason to believe or a story or a mm-hmm. message. And so I think those are the two things. I think he saw the logic mm-hmm. and he saw the commitment. And I think in launching any business, as creative and innovative as it is or whatever it is, at the end of the day, there's a certain amount of focus, logic, and commitment that needs to drive the business.
And your logic was, this is a new category, healthy food, people are starting to move towards it, it's getting bigger, right? What about the idea that at the time people were losing their homes, they were upside down in their mortgages, they were in financial trouble, they lost their jobs. Why did you think that people would still buy this new drink that was more expensive?
Yeah, I think at the time it was so clear that the whole better for you healthy movement in food and drinks was a tide that was rising and that would lift all ships, right, for that. So I think ultimately in any new business, knowing that you're part of a rising tide helps offset a lot of other macro influences that could thwart, you know, your objective.
Right. If I'm trying to eat healthier, even if a soda is an old traditional soda is cheaper than the healthy drink, it's not that much cheaper. I'm going to move to the healthy drink. And that's what you were seeing in the world.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's talk about then how you got it right into bottles, how you how I know that you had some challenges with getting this, getting the product put together, bottling it, getting into stores. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, first off was that we're making a drink and that ferments and putting it into a bottle. And so a couple of things that we had to innovate around. One was, you know, how do you make it and scale it? Others were making it and not trying to find economic ways of scaling it. And so one of the first things I wanted to do was say, how do I create a manufacturing process where we could cost effectively make more in less time? And that was the first challenge. And how do we make it and get it into the bottle cost effectively? Co-packing, we had a lot of challenges in going out to co-packers because quality and cost was really sketchy. So once we worked through how to make a lot of it for less time, normally kombucha takes 30 days, give or take. And normally they make it in 5-gallon jugs, you know, give or take. And some great brands out there are still doing that, give or take. Things are changing very much. But some of the great brands out there the one that I respect, GT Dave, I know GT, and what he did with his kombucha was amazing. And he's, you know, the icon of the category. So he had his way, and we wanted to do it a different way to have better economics so that we could appeal to a larger company, strategic company to sell it. So finding a way to make it in a much more cost-effective way was important. We checked that box. So then, you know, we ultimately built our own bottling facility. We realized that paying, you know, exorbitant rates, having low quality with someone else co-packing or co-manufacturing it wasn't the way to go. So, you know, we raised give or take $10 million dedicated to doing our own line. And I hired a young man out of Pepperdine University who was an MBA and who just had a penchant for operations and supply chain. I mean, he could have went anywhere. Could have been, you know, could have worked for Apple or Google or, you know, because he had that kind of intellect and interest and skills, 360. And he wanted to go on the manufacturing supply chain. So he came, and after 6 months, he conceived of and built this manufacturing line that was state of the art that PepsiCo still uses, and replicated it on the East Coast to increase production for them. So we made our own bottling line, and that gave us control. That brought down cost, which made us ultimately compete at price and have strong gross profit margins. So when a big strat wants to buy a company, especially in this space, you know, at least with PepsiCo, they didn't want to just buy some company that had a lot of revenue. And companies do. They buy revenue. They really wanted a company that had profitability. So we built and told our business so that we can not only grow and take share, but also increase product margin and gross profit margin. We did that by owning our own production line.
If you see me looking down, it's because I keep taking notes on what you're saying. And then I've got follow-up questions to ask you, like, how do you promote this? Why doesn't Pepsi and Coke, why don't they just create these products by themselves? It looks like they have a habit of buying them. How you got together with Pepsi and a few other questions. Let me tell you about my second sponsor. It's a company called TopTal. In fact, instead of telling you about them, I'll tell you what happened with my kid's school this week. We got an email from the school, we're talking pre-K. They're sending us a Zoom link. I go, Zoom link? This is the school. We're paying them tons of money. I literally paid for months and months while my kid was in the womb to lock in the spot at the school in San Francisco. If we ever wanted to reach them, they don't answer email except for once a week. If you want to talk to them, just walk, take your shoes off, and go talk to them in person. They're that old school. So they're doing Zoom because the kids' school is closed and they want the kids to get to know each other and to do their singing circle and so on. So I get on with Zoom with them. They don't even know how to operate Zoom. Every kid is screaming on the mic, and they don't know that they could just mute the Zoom for everybody, but they're on it. They're playing with it. The other kid's school is sending me this resource to learn math at home using software. I go, holy moly, these schools that were like pride themselves on being Luddites are now encouraging software. This is the future. Software still is here. Software still is growing. And if you're out there in a software space and you still believe in this space and want to expand your business right, I'm going to introduce you to a company that will let you hire phenomenal developers. We're talking about Silicon Valley developers at lower prices because these people are working internationally, often from their homes. And it's a company you've heard me talk about with past guests who have raved about working with them. It's called TopTal. And now more than ever, if you're looking to hire developers, just start a conversation with the people at TopTal. They will start you off by talking to a matcher, understanding your needs, then going out and finding within their network the best of the best developers. Then talk to them, interview them. If you're happy, great. If you're not, you've lost nothing. And if you use my special URL, you're going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period. They have worked with me and my audience for years. My audience has loved them, which is why they keep coming back and buying up all my ads. And so I recommend you try the thing that has saved so many other companies and helped them grow. It's called toptal.com/mixergy as a URL to get that special offer. It's toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. Go call them up. Even if you're not ready to hire right now, get to know what's possible for you with TopTal. What do you think of that, Bill? That was a pretty good read. It wasn't even a read. It was just me talking. I always wonder, like, as a salesperson, what's going through your head as I'm doing a sales pitch for my sponsor? Does it feel like uncomfortable, like a shtick? Or do you say, wow, this guy's good?
I think it's part of what makes it work, and you're good at it. So I was listening to how you took a personal experience and you connected with a sponsor, and that was perfect, beautiful.
Yeah, thanks. So. Are you into self-improvement? I know you had that yoga place. I am. Are you still into it?
I am. I'm certainly, I certainly focus on myself when I give myself the time.
What? I told you, I've got photos of you from before in preparation for this interview. You've got like a real charismatic look here. People are not going to get it because they're listening, but maybe some of it will carry off. You've always looked professional. Now you've got something. What are you doing to improve yourself? What's one weird or different thing that's uniquely yours that you've done to improve?
Well, I mean, I've created my own sort of morning workout program, which is what I did this morning. So I did, and you know, it's a combination of yoga, core training, breathing exercises, and meditation. I mean, I have this. I put together a little bit of everything, and at the end of the day, the other thing I did this morning, which was really interesting, I bought this. This I guess it's a swing or something, or it's like a yoga swing, and I get inside of it, and you could flip yourself upside down and you could hang upside down for a long period of time, and I did that for probably like 6-7 minutes, and I think it kind of, you know, makes me feel better. So yeah, I mean, I think everybody needs to find their own sort of, you know, I mean, some of the greatest entrepreneurs are not only great thinkers, workers, leaders, execution-oriented masters, but they're also ones that really have a deep sense of balance and focus on themselves. Some it comes naturally. They don't have to really do much to have that deep center and that inner health, and they do what they do to keep themselves healthy. Others have to do more and work harder.
And for you, which is it? Do you have to?
Somewhere in the middle. Yeah, somewhere in the middle. I some of it comes natural, but if I'm not, if I'm not focused on it and really working it, then I could look like I look in some of the photos, which is not as healthy as I.
What do you do? I've never seen you look not healthy, but maybe in your mind, it's not as healthy as you could be. What do you do to make sure that you stay on top of it?
I schedule it.
If it's in your calendar, it happens.
It absolutely, if I don't fit it in my calendar, because I'm busy, I wake up and, you know, wake up at 3:30 in the morning, and I can't wait to get to work. So when you get into that sort of, when you get that rush, literally, and then physically you want to rush and move, unless you schedule time to like stop and take care of yourself, it never happens. And it usually, if you don't do it in the morning time, even more unlikely. It's usually by the end of the day.
So. That's true for me. Yeah. I need some app, and it's always a run. I love running. It's my thing. And still, I won't do it unless there's an app that tells me, here's how many times you've done it this week. And I know I want to hit at least four days, at least 5 miles. It's weird how we need these external pushes. By the way, I've always had this question. Why does PepsiCo not see the same thing that you're seeing, do the same math you're doing and say, all right, people want drinks, probiotic drinks, healthy drinks. We're going to get into this. We see this guy, Bill, he's somewhere in the middle of the country or somewhere out there. We're going to jump into it and beat him. Why do they never do that?
Well, they try to from time to time. They have, you know, brand extensions or line extensions with Gatorade or et cetera.
But it's really buy it. They didn't create. Oh, yeah, they did Powerade, right? Is the competitor Powerade thing? Okay.
So I mean, look, I mean, it's really hard. Even Coke. I mean, it's funny because when I initially went to, I think this was actually what was going on. I went into Pepsi. I got a term sheet. They got cold feet at the 11th hour because they felt like they could do it internally. So I went to Coke. Went down to Atlanta, met with Coke, got a term sheet from them, and my banker showed Pepsi the term sheet from Coke, and then Pepsi closed right away because they felt like they wouldn't want to miss out.
Got it.
So I think ultimately, you know, PepsiCo and Coke and other big brands, other big CPG companies really do look for innovation outside of their ecosystem because by nature, they can't think beyond their box when you're in that big institutionalized box. So that's the same reason why the Microsofts or the Googles or the Amazons, they ultimately acquire new innovative companies that would take, it's just difficult to innovate out of your given box internally. So I think that's what they realize.
And did they make an initial investment before they did the acquisition? They did.
They made an initial investment and then they sat on the board and gave us some good insights on compliance and legal and distribution, helped us with distribution to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
There was a built-in option that at a certain time triggered their ability to buy us. And it was really interesting. Then in June of 16 was the first month that their option opened. It was a 12-month option. And we were growing exponentially. And I was so hopeful that they would wait, and they didn't, because valuation was predicated on that.
Yeah.
Actually, I talked to the board and I was saying, well, maybe we should message them that we're not ready to sell and we don't want to sell, even though they're contractually obligated because they don't want to buy. They might, and we decided not to do that, which is probably a good idea. But, you know, I mean, look, I mean, had we held the company for another year, we would have gotten twice as much money for it because we were growing that fast. So.
And the way they do it is they do this as an investment because they want to learn and they want to make sure that it really why did they do this? Because I think Jesse Itzler from Zico told me he had a similar situation.
Right. I mean, look, I mean, they still do it. They love young entrepreneurial companies, and they like once they qualify the category, they invest, they take a board seat or a board observer seat, and they want to watch the company from the inside out to get to know it, to help it, and then they get comfortable with it, and then ultimately, many times, not all, they have an option as part of their investment to that triggers upon a certain, you know, when they get to a certain size that they could buy it. It's just an option; it's not an obligation. So you know, the company really does, because if PepsiCo or Coke or Nestle, or if they invest and then they walk away, the company's really in trouble. Because other potential buyers will look at it as the kiss of death. Mm. Why didn't they do that? And that's the big concern. Yeah.
You know, I've got one other question about that, and then we'll come into Flying Embers, which I've got here. And that is, how did you promote? I've seen this, as I said, I've seen Kavita in my house. I've seen it at stores. I've never in my life seen an ad. How does anybody even know to go buy it? What do you do to get more sales?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's 70% of this category is shopped at point of sale, not through, you know, radio or out of home is what they call it. So, we did a lot of demos. I mean, you know, we did millions and millions of dollars a year. I think the 2016, we did $2.5 million of demos at point of sale. We were at all the different festivals. We did do, and they do now, digital. Geo-targeting digital, so that when you're going into a store, you could be hit and digitized. Also, customer-specific marketing, where retailers have loyalty programs. Albertsons has what's called Just For You. So when you check out, you can get a promotion on something else based on what your basket, what you're shopping.
The coupons that they print out?
Exactly.
But there's also online promotions based on what people buy in the stores if they're part of these membership programs.
That's correct. So that's also relevant. But yeah, I think as it relates to the Better For You space, it's not a lot of traditional advertising. And it's really high touch interaction. It's a hand sell. And I think ultimately that's, and then it's word of mouth. And then
what's the festival?
Coachella, Lightning in a Bottle festivals.
Got it. Okay. Got it. Also, I guess that's where the label is so important, but even the flavor names like mojito, lemon, mint, coconut, right? Like, you got to just try and see what that is. If I would have seen that, I would have bought it just to see what it is. All right, then you sold. You were done. Why come back with Flying Embers, this organic hard kombucha?
Good question. I was noticing that the Better For You alcohol space was where the non-alc space was 10, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, who's really built a company and a brand around Better For You alcohol? And so I went to work and I saw people that were drinking kombucha that actually liked it when it went over the legal limit. And I said, well, why not make a kombucha that actually had alcohol on it, since the non-alc kombucha manufacturers were doing everything to keep it out, even though people kind of wanted it. A lot of people said,
people would feel it, that even a little bit of alcohol that's in kombucha.
They'd feel it and they liked it. And so we found out that, that was a whole marketplace that wasn't being tapped into for it. So
how do you know that people want healthy alcohol? What I'm seeing is they always seem to want alcohol that isn't painful in the mouth, right? They want the thing that makes them feel like they're not drinking alcohol, but still get the buzz. It feels like I can see that.
Like the seltzer,
right? And then before that, there was the Bartles and James a long time ago. And all these things come out to say, I know you want to drink alcohol, but you don't like the taste. This is going to make it easier. I haven't seen anything that says people want a healthier drink. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that became a phenomenon was, what's not in it that makes it healthy? So what's not in it? As you look at the seltzer market, from the non-alc seltzer to the elk seltzer, it's about sessionability and what's not in it. Low carbs, no carbs, low calorie, no sugar, low sugar. So my bet is that creating something more crafty for the craft drinker that actually has the newer one next to you has no sugar, no carbs. One over here.
This one has no gluten, no, like the, it's a list of all the things it doesn't have.
Yeah. So we check the box on what it doesn't have. And then we go ahead and put things in there that make it better for you, like adaptogens, and probiotics, live probiotics. So that by making something that is craftier, it's got a little bit more flavor profile, you put more in it, the bet is that this is the next generation, better for you alcohol product that goes beyond what's not in it with the seltzers. And trying to bring identify another target audience that wants more in their drink than what they're getting.
It says 0 grams sugar right here. But when I look at the ingredients, I see sugar.
Right. We make it with sugar, we ferment it dry. So when you ferment it completely dry, you have no residual sugar in it. So yeah, it's part of the ingredients because initially we start with it. So yeah, you're by law compelled to put it on.
Oh, it's part of the manufacturing process, but it's not in the end product.
That's correct. It's for, yeah, you use sugar to ferment, and then you ferment it all the way dry.
You know what? I never even noticed that it's 100 calories. I think because it's bigger than a standard soda can, I thought that it would have more calories. I'm not a calorie counter that way, but
Wow. The 12 ounces are 85 calories, and the 16 is, yeah. So
yeah, I got a 16. Yeah. They hooked me up, dude. I got to tell you, your people, I can see so much in a company based on the people who I deal with. There are people right now who are pitching so aggressively to be on Mixergy and like this. And I could see that their staff has no clue about what's going on in the world and no consideration. I don't know, Julia, I don't know, Susan, you know, they work for you, right?
Yeah.
These are amazing people. The level of consideration, it's not like they just took care of me with this. It's just, I messaged them last night. I said, here's the situation in San Francisco. What can we do? There's always like a sense of heart without feeling like they're, I don't know, too much. Really good people.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really important.
I don't know where I'm going with that, but I get such a good feeling with some companies when I see the people who work with them.
Thank you.
And so now, how are you going to survive in a recession? We're about to go through pretty tough economic times.
You know, they say alcohol is recession-proof, but it's not whenever they shut down all the bars and restaurants, right?
Right.
That's, you know, so we're, you know, actually our sales are up. I mean, you know, we're still a relatively small company. We just went national and, you know, we're, so we just got into a lot of different, we got into a lot of retailers, Publix, Harris Teeter, Wegmans, Albertsons, Vaughn's, you know, et cetera. But all of a sudden, they're doing their resets, their spring resets, where they take out the old, the deleted items, they put in the new ones, and we're like in the back room, neither, you know, unable to get on the shelf yet with a lot of it. But nonetheless, we are in, 5,000 doors nationwide, and we know that the resets are going to be coming, and our business is up. We had a record week last week. I mean, ultimately, what do people want? I mean, they want to drink at home, even if they're cooped up, and they want to drink something that makes them feel good about drinking. And the usage occasion for this is not just at a party or something that is, you know, it's not something that's crushable. It's something that really invokes a little bit more, you know, just intention that I'm going to drink something that actually could, you know, affect my overall well-being, even though it's got 4.5% alcohol in it. And so I think that proposition, that value proposition has never really been put to market in alcohol. And while it's a small, and we've done a lot of data, it's a small slice of the adult beverage market, it's growing. And those that can deliver an authentic brand that really tastes commercial enough, but actually has something in it, I think, yeah, so we're seeing that people are buying it. We have floor stacks in different places around the country competing against Michelob Ultra Light, et cetera. And we're in selective stores. We're selling more. So we'll see.
I got to tell you, it tastes great. I'm not a kombucha drinker. I told you, I know everywhere I go in San Francisco, if they got, if they want to keep the San Francisco techies working in their office, they have one of those little kombucha handles where you can. I've never been into that. This I like. I think it's milder than kombucha. It has a flavor that doesn't feel like. I don't want to drink. I haven't tried the seltzer drinks yet, but I want to feel something. I want to feel something that slows me down a little bit. I'm not trying to get drunk when I drink alcohol. I want to feel quiet and appreciative and have a conversation, and it does that.
Yeah, just chill out. You want to chill. You want to relax. I mean, alcohol does relax you before it inebriates you. And you know, our whole intention is, you know, this is about, you know, conscious consumption. And so yeah, that's what we're all about.
All right. And now that I would usually drink it here, but I've got a big day of interviews while I'm still at the office. And for once, I drove it instead of riding my bike. So I want to be careful. But now that we've done the interview, I got the cans here. I get the drink with my wife, which is an exciting thing. She usually drinks wine and I usually drink whiskey. Now we've got something we can drink together and I'm looking forward to it. Thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate you being here today. It's been a tough day around the world. And like I said, I talked to your team last night and I appreciate that they said, yes, let's do it today.
Thank you. We're really, really good.
You bet. The company is called, and the can and the drink is called Flying Embers. Now you can find it in a lot of stores, and you can also ask them for it in case they're not putting it on display. Flying Embers. The one that I'm going to try next is the Ancient Berry. And I know the one that Olivia is going to go for. She's going to go for the one that has turmeric. For some reason lately, anything with turmeric, she's been drinking. I want to thank you for doing this. And thank you to the two sponsors, HostGator and TopTal. Bye, everyone. Be well.